number of guys on Long Island that have a doppel scan of the quality that you've got right now.
Well, I know of two. I know Andy's got one, and I know Larry's got one. So, but there's the eight antenna ones. But I think mine is the first four antennas I saw that worked this well.
Okay, so in other words, one approach is eight antennas that are very carefully done, and your approach is that if you do it correctly with the right kind of ground loop subtraction and so on, by having a common ground plane for everything, you believe that four antennas will give you the accuracy and the resolution. In other words, each of the light-emitting diodes on that circular display represent, I'm going to pick a number, 15 or 20 degrees. Do those lights move in a fairly continuous manner as you drive circles around the block? Go ahead.
Yes, they do now, Dick. And the other thing, too, is that keep in mind, in Mobile, you don't need super-duper accuracy. You just have to know, is it coming off of, you know, the front of the car, the back of the car, or to the side? That's good enough. I mean, think about it, because you just need a direction that you've got to know where you have to start driving. So Mobile is, you know, not as critical for a super-duper, as long as the bearing that you have is good, so that you know, hey, it's in this direction, or should I make a turn here? Or, you know, look at the parkways on maps and figure out, oh, maybe I should get on this parkway and start going up in that direction. That's really what's important. You don't need super pinpoint, you know, accuracy. And the other thing you notice, too, is that the closer you start getting to a target and the signal starts getting much, much stronger, you're right on top of it. You'll know that when you're going around the block that it's on, or, you know, you're right around that little local area. Because, like you said, as you drive around that block, it just circles it right there. Am I missing something? Oh, one other thing, Dick, about the other antennas, the eight antenna systems and the two other gentlemen that I mentioned, theirs are also on plates as well. Even though it's eight antennas, they're on plates, and that's where I initially got the idea to start going to a better ground plane, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That's very good sounding information, Glenn. Does the system overload? And I guess it's a function of whether or not your handy-talkie or whatever you're using for the receiver overloads. When you get super close to the target, does anything funny happen? That's question number one. And question number two, under so-called normal conditions, I know you only need north, south, east, west, so to speak, as you drive, is the majority of the information you need. What do you believe is the biggest angular error you now get now that it's a fairly well tuned? In other words, if you know the signal is really to the east, but it indicates 15 degrees further north or 15 degrees further south, is that approximately what you get now occasionally? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, Dick, I don't really have a super calibrated measurement to give you, but I can give you a basic idea. If I take an HT and walk around my vehicle now and basically just put it on the high power, and I walk around the vehicle, and I don't see anything that looks like overloading, but basically it follows me probably to within 20 degrees of accuracy as I walk around that vehicle.
Great. That's good enough. Somebody want to make a comment?
Yeah, good evening. This is Lou in Y2H. Just wondering, Glenn, you didn't answer the question Dick had asked about the switching duty cycle on those antennas. Maybe you want to address that.
Yeah, I was sort of asking, is the switching network a break before make? And what do you believe is the on-off ratio of those pin diodes that you're using at each antenna? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, that circuit, Dick, it uses basically a 500 hertz oscillator, and when I put my oscilloscope on it without antennas on it, in other words, I just used a four channel, and I basically looked at the four antennas when it's on just to make sure that the ports are working. Basically the duty cycle looked something pretty close to 50%. So, I'm way off on that one. It's 25%. So in other words, minus some delays between them, but it's pretty darn close to it. So say between 20 and 25%, because basically what it's doing is it's on and on one antenna and there's four antennas. So basically the on time over 500 hertz. So 500 hertz is the, 1 over 500 hertz is the period, and the duty cycle is one-fourth that, or a little bit less than one-fourth for each antenna.
Yeah, I have the impression that if you had a four-channel oscilloscope, and you could slow the system down, and stroboscopically you could do that, in other words, you make the synchronization just a little bit off, you would see the pulse that's feeding the active pin diode network walk through the four channels and slant to the right as it does it in time, so to speak. That's what I think you're saying. What do you believe is the on-off ratio that you're getting on each antenna, Glenn? Go ahead.
I thought I just said that. It's just a little bit less than 25%. You know, because you do have a little bit of a spike on the leading edge, but once the grounding and the shielding gets better, most of that spike pretty much goes away, Dick.
This situation reminds me of the joke of the two flight attendants, two flight lieutenants come to the wife's front door to tell her that her husband just died in an air crash. And she asks, what was he doing at the time? And they say, oh, about Mach 1.5. I asked you, what is the on-off ratio? You gave me a time domain answer. I'm asking for an amplitude domain answer. How many decibels of on-off ratio, of RF response of an antenna in the on-off ratio do you believe you're getting? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick, I misunderstood. I don't think it's very, very high. I don't have an actual measurement of it, but I can tell you that when I turn off the Doppler system and when I turn it off, I probably have about somewhere around 30 dB of rejection. So in other words, even if the antennas are on and I turn it off and I just look at, you know, what's, you know, because there's no 5 volts to any of the pin switches, so I would say that between a signal that's on and if I freeze the antenna in any one position, so I'd say that there's somewhere between, say, 25 and 30 dB is maximum, Dick. Certainly no more than that.
I think that's way more than enough. So you have reason to believe you've got 25 to 30 decibels of on-off ratio. I think the system would function with anything more than about 15. So, You've got some margin on that one. Very good. Sounds like you've got it down to a science. How difficult do you believe now would it be for people to duplicate what you've got? In other words, if our organization was really enthusiastic and we wanted to build four more in a hurry, it sounds to me like you've got it down to a science where a guy could start off with a raw Ramsey kit as delivered and get it into your form in, let me pick a number, and you're going to agree or disagree. Could a guy do it in 8 man hours, do you think, Glenn? Go ahead.
I'm not sure. I think that, let me put it to you this way. If we kitted it properly and put, you know, got all the parts in expensively and laid it all out, it's possible. Right now, it's not that well organized yet. We're very loosely confederated with this project. So there's one other person working on it right now. I think you know who it probably is. And I'm not sure how much success he has. And I've been kind of waiting to hear some feedback. And I just kind of finished mine more as a prototype. But here again, I think I'd like to see his performance, and then we can compare notes to see how well he's doing and make sure that we're all on the same page here first, and then take it from there, Dick.
Well done, Glenn. Sounds like you've done some really good work. Sounds like you've got it down just about to a science. Up till now, I was becoming a little bit skeptical as to whether or not 4 samples per cycle of analog to digital conversion, if I was trying to sample a sine wave, figure out what's going on. That's sort of what we're doing here. Would that really be enough? I think you're slowly convincing me that 4 is enough. 6 or 8 is a little bit better, but maybe it's beyond the knee of the curve. We might already be into the law of diminishing returns. 4 a particular application, like a mobile application, but maybe for a fixed application, more antennas might be better. We'll soon find out. As I said, keep up the good work. I think I've gone through the list of everyone who has signed in. I'm going to double check on that. And if not, we'll get into the slightly deeper stuff. Now, the slightly deeper stuff, we're getting mixed responses on this. There are people who say, why the hell are you guys doing that? There are other groups of guys are saying, hey, this is what I want to hear. I really want to know at the molecular level what's really happening. So I'm getting mixed responses. There are people who like it and there are people who hate it. Well, for the people who hate it, this is not the only channel to listen to. There is a knob on the front panel where you can turn it off or tune to something else. What these group of people are trying to do now is educate each other. We know we're in an area where we've got rather limited knowledge. So let me double check now to make sure I haven't missed anybody. Are the people who signed in with the so-called fast questions, so to speak, have we covered every one of them? Have I forgotten anybody? K2RIW?
I think, Julio, I have a little something that I think would be of interest.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I think everybody knows I'm into restoring the vintage radios from the 60s, mainly 60s, some 70s, and I brought this up once before, but you know, it works out so well for me, I wanted to repeat it. I looked for a way, after repairing these radios, I looked for a way to get the dirt and grunge and grease out of them. And what I first did was I took an old Junker Collins KWM2 that had parts picked out of it, and I stuck it in the dishwasher, as crazy as that sounds, and came out very clean. I dissected some of the IF cams to see if there was any damage. There was no damage. So this was about a year ago. I'm going to recycle. So about a year ago, I held my breath, and I took my precious KWM2A. The key is I took all the tubes out, took the meter out, because you don't want water in the meter, took the knobs off, and put it in the dishwasher. And boy, was I pleasantly surprised. It came out sparkling clean, almost like a new radio. I did not apply power to it for a month because I didn't want to have something arc over. Since then, I've done, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 radios. The reason I'm bringing it up, I did one tonight. I'm doing an AM rig for 6 and 2 meters. Let me have it reset. A company called Amico, American Electronics Corporation, which at the time was a subsidiary of Aerotron, back in the 60s into the early 70s, made something called the TX-62 Amico transmitter, 75 watts input, screen grid modulated for 6 and 2 meters. Anyway, I took one of those. I cleaned it up tonight. I did the repairs on it. You know, it had a bad filter capacitor and whole host of other problems. Somebody tweaked the adjustments. I got everything working. Took the meter out, took the tubes off, took the knobs off, stuck in the dishwasher. I used a little Cascade soap, dishwashing soap. I found through experimentation you don't want to use too much dishwashing soap. If you use too much, it tends to... I had one radio, it damaged some potentiometers that had to be replaced. So now I use about half the normal amount of soap that you would use in a normal dishwashing cycle. I run it through in the normal cycle. I take it out as soon as the dishwasher finishes. I do not leave it in for the drying process with the high heat temperature. I don't think that's a good idea. And it comes out clean. And then I let it sit for about a month. Paint transformer black again. And it looks like a new radio and works great. I just wanted to pass that along, Dick. And on the Collins, by the way.
K-E-2-E-J.
Okay, Eric recognized. On the Collins stuff, there's a big myth about the PTOs being very delicate. They're not delicate at all. I don't cover the PTOs. I don't do anything, and everything works fine. On one radio, the PTO went out of alignment a little bit, and even after a month, I saw every time I turned the radio on, it slowly dried. It must have been a little moisture in there. It came back to normal. It took about 2 months to come back to normal. But no damage to anything except one radio, like I said, where I used an inordinate amount of dishwashing soap. The potentiometer's got damaged. Now I use half the normal soap, and it works out very, very well. Done a whole bunch of radios this way. They look great. They work great. Back to that. Pick up Eric Dick at 2EO. That's all I got.
Interesting. Takes a lot of nerves to put something with IF cans into a dishwasher. And I guess I would worry about the solutions getting inside the potentiometers and have trouble getting back out. I'm not sure that the inside of a potentiometer needs cleaning. I'd be tempted to do something to protect them. And I think I'd do the same thing with the opening holes on the IF can. I don't think I'd want the dishwashing soap going into the IF can, but looks like you're getting away with it. Eric, KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2KEY to comment on the subject.
Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, K2RW and N2EL, KE2J. I've been doing that for years, Dick. The only thing that I do different that you don't, Rich, is that I will take the finished out of the dishwasher, put it in 120 to 130 degree oven for about 6 or 8 hours, let the thing cool off, and then I don't have any problem turning power on to it. It forces all the water out of it, and I've never had a problem with pots or coils. Most coils most coil forms are saturated with wax to start with, so it kind of protects them. And as long as you drive the water throughout, and you really want to do it with heat, Rich, you don't want to wait that long because things tend to oxidize. You force the water out quickly, you don't have those problems. Back here to K2RW, KE2.
Eric, what is the most elaborate piece of electronics you've done that with? A Collins transceiver, I can see that. Would you do that with a video camera, like a broadcast camera? What's the most elaborate piece of electronics you've had the nerve to put into a dishwasher? Over to you, Eric.
How about a Tektronix 7000 series scope? I've done quite a few of them that way. I've done an old Collins broadcast exciter for an AM transmitter. I've done, what else? I've done a number of FM transmitters. I've done some World War II stuff. Although you got to watch it with the World War II stuff and the paper capacitors. Some of them are not well sealed and usually have to replace them anyway because they're so old. But there are a whole series of things, and I'm not afraid to do it. It works out fine.
Well, I wouldn't have the nerve to do that. I'd have to be talked into it. Wonder how many of those you've done, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, at the place we had an ultrasonic cleaning system, cleaning vest that we put a lot of electronics in, with special fluid in there, and went through filters after that to remove the dirt from the system, and never saw anything really go wrong. But years back, I visited once a place where they used to do the reconditioning of Hewlett Packard equipment, all kinds of test equipment, recalibration, clean it up, and everything. Everything that came in was usually washed down. And what they did is it used very little water. There was water in the system, but they used high pressure air. It was under a lot of pressure, maybe a couple hundred pounds of pressure, but it was using very little water actually mixed with this air. And it was amazing. It just blasted the dirt, right, blasted and go into this thing with a lot of jets, and it just blasted everything clean. So I've washed down a lot of stuff. I wouldn't bring it in the house. I actually took a hose. Let me drop and I'll tell you one incident I had. I once picked up a nice piece of equipment, and I suspected where it came from. I said, I'm not going to take this into the house, and a good reason. I opened up, took the thing out of this cabinet. It was loaded with roaches. If I would have brought that into the house, good night. That was in the end. So I washed it down. I had it in the driveway. I washed that thing down with just the hose, and that was it. I just gave it a good bath over.
KC2 QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I have a funny story here, but not that this is the ideal situation, but back when I bought my first HF ham rig, it was at a ham fest in Islip, when they used to have the old Islip Speedway, and it was raining terribly that day. I mean, oh, the rain was pouring down, and by the time I got there, there was some equipment in this one ham, we were selling equipment, had this Swan SW240. And it was sitting underneath a bench that he had set up there, and it was in a puddle. Dick, when I tell you, this thing was half submerged when I pulled it out. I saw the unit at the time, and I was just a kid, and I was like, oh, I just got to bring this thing home. So I brought it home, dried it off with a dryer, and completely pulled the covers off, took a hair dryer, and just dried it off with hot heat, and dried everything out, let it sit for about 2 days. I turned it on and used it for like 3 or 4 years and never had a problem with it. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
And that's a very different philosophy that Mel and Glenn have compared to some guys who buy used equipment. There are guys who buy used equipment where they want to know how long it's been used, how many hours has it been turned on, do they have the original packing material? Do they have the original instruction manual? Are there any scratches on the front cover? You know, the cosmetics, and there are people who want to know the complete pedigree, history, and whatever. And a slightly more crafty guy will say that, hey, that's a piece of electronics I want, even if it's got a slightly dented front panel, as long as it's not an empty case where somebody's been cannibalizing the parts, as long as 95% of what I want is in that box. There's very few chunks of electronics that have a single valuable component. Yeah, a $700 tube and a half kilowatt amplifier, 8877, or a kilowatt amplifier, that's a valuable item, and you want to make sure the tube has got a good filament and it doesn't have air inside. It's still got a vacuum. Let me drop.
More comments too, Dick?
Okay, I'll go to you in a second, but when it comes to most of our rigs, the most valuable item, if there is one, is the transformer, or if there's a cathode ray tube, the cathode ray tube is the most valuable thing. Other than that, every other part inside is replaceable, from my point of view. And so if you're a crafty ham and you've got a friend like Andy, the BA2CDL, that can troubleshoot anything, the more it's dented, the lower price you've got to pay at the flea market, and the more of a bargain you're going to get. As long as you got the right attitude. Over to you, Glenn.
It was just a funny story with this radio because it really had a great history. It was my first HF ham radio, and I wound up, the only thing I had to do to this radio in the whole life that I owned it was it had aluminum covers on it. That's, you know, the Swan SW240, that's what it had, these aluminum covers. I spray painted them black and put them back on it, and the radio looked beautiful as well. It was amazing how well this thing operated after that. And actually, I owned it for quite a few more years until I actually started upgrading to some better equipment. And then when I was working at Microwave Power Devices, somebody you know, Mike Cosma, just got into the hobby, and he was looking for an HF rig. And I said, you know, I have an old one lying around. And he's like, yeah, bring it in. And he hooked it up to a signal generator, saw that it had beautiful sensitivity. I think he was set up an HP generator, and so it was like minus 107 dB microvolts. And he's like, look at this thing. It's look at the sensitivity of this receiver. And he wound up buying it, and he owned it for quite a few years. So that's the history of that radio, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Here we go.
Yeah, I know by Cosma, and it's possible it did a little more than minus 107 dBm. That's only one microvolt, and most good receivers working correctly go down to a fraction of a microvolt. Go ahead, Rich.
In a lot of cases, I know what Glenn is saying, because in a lot of cases what I do is I buy a few of the same model, you know, ones that are advertised on eBay is junk as the bot. I bought a third TX-62 tonight, and I'm getting it with the VFO, the 621 VFO, that is very hard to find. And what I'm doing is I've got this one that I restored. I've got this one coming in, and I've got a junk of a part. So I'll use the parts from the worst one to fix this other one, keep the VFO, resell the other TX-62, and keep one for myself with the VFO. So this is a relatively inexpensive way to get vintage gear. The TX-62 I restored in the last couple of days cost me $78.
You've sent me pictures from time to time of the rigs that you've restored and the nice shelves that you've put them on in your shack. And I can tell you take a lot of pride in restoring these things and making them really look good. I've got a question for you, Rich. If I come to visit you and I want to start fingering some of those pieces of electronics, opening up the case, look inside, twiddle the knobs and whatever, do you have a set of white cotton gloves that you can hand me to make sure I don't put fingerprints on them? Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, you're welcome here anytime you want to take a look. I do, believe it or not, seriously, I have asked people to wash their hands.
I was guessing that that might take place, that you take that much pride. And apparently you really enjoy it. If you saw the fingerprints on some of my rigs, you'd be a little bit unhappy. I go more for function than for beauty. But to each his own. I mean, this is a hobby. There's at least 26 different kinds of ham radio, and if you talk, and that's even before I counted restoring electronics. Okay. I'm changing subjects now. What Wesley did is he mailed me a set of emails which had a display from a man named, a presentation from a man named Nassim Haramian, I think his name is, a man who lives in Hawaii, who went to a major physics conference in Europe and presented a radical paper, and it was voted the best paper of that particular conference. And then he made another presentation in Australia at something called the Nexus Conference. And so the guy has got a very interesting point of view. He's coming at it from a very different point of view. Let me drop.
WS2N with that information if you want before you want to get if you want to do this next week, let me know, Dick.
Yeah, if it's brief, go ahead.
Yeah, it's brief. I think let me just jump in there. It's a detector, not going up on this flight, but the next flight. That's why we didn't see it on the website. You got to look on STS at 130-134, the Endeavor flight. One Mark Kelly commander on. It's the AMS 02. It stands for Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. It's a particle physics detector. The thing weighs 14,000 pounds. They have
pictures of it, you can see, you know, there's a man standing next to one, and it's bigger than he is. It's going to be bolted to the space station. Detect cosmic rays. Let me drop it. It's going to really be looking for antimatter, dark matter. Heats up about 2,000, a little over 2,000 watts of power as they're using it. Planned operation is 15 years, so it's not a cryogenically cooled one. They made a similar one and put it onto a shuttle for a week or so many years ago that was cryogenically cooled, but that without the proper refrigeration equipment, you can't keep that up, so eventually that bleeds off. So there you go, Dick. It's www.ams, that stands for Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, 02, the number 02.org. So www.ams02.org, and then there's plenty of more information about this thing on that website, you know, all of the different gadgets, detectors, and what's involved on the, you know, in putting this thing together. And the years that went into it, the 600 scientists behind it, when it was conceived, after they dropped the super colliding conductor project out in Texas, they came up with this thing. There you go, Dick. That's the story on it. I think that's the one you were speaking about. WS1.
Yes, that is definitely the one. However, I thought there was only one more space shuttle to be launched. You're making it sound like there's two more. I thought the very next flight was the last one. You're telling me there's two more flights, Paul, go ahead.
Yes, there's this one going up in February. The end of February. And then you got the Endeavour flight with Mark Kelly as commander. That's STS 134. Now a new one that's just been approved. The Congress has been fighting to get this thing approved for a long time, and that just happened recently within the last couple of days. And that's the Atlantis flight, June 28th, STS 135, four-man crew. That's just going to be really a cargo flight type of thing, just supplying the space station with every last thing that they could think of before the shuttle ends. That will be the final flight.
Okay, so there's really three more flights as of the latest approval. Wow. What's your guess, Paul, as to whether or not there'll be four more?
No. I'm going to say 1% chance of that happening. No, it's come to a grinding halt. They've talked about this as a possibility for a long time, getting the final one on board. Now, these things have been delayed, and that's why it drifts off. Originally, when President Bush did away with it, it was 2010, but here we are in 2011. They didn't say that, well, 2010, that's it, they're all off. They said, well, front all the flights, there's no delays, it should have been done by then, but, you know, that was a long time ago, so that's why it's, now this final one is in June, so with more delays, you know, that might drift into, you know, July, August, September, who knows, but no more planned flights after that.
Each shuttle flight not only brings up hardware and personnel and brings personnel back down and brings up consumables, it also uses its excess fuel on board to do boosting of the whole International Space Station to a slightly higher orbit because it's continuously decaying. So each one of the next three missions, I am guessing, are going to be doing boosting. Once the shuttle flights are thoroughly canceled, is there any doubt in your mind, Paul, as to whether or not the Progress ships will be coming up often enough with enough excess fuel to do the proper amount of boosting, because if you don't do the boosting, you're eventually going to lose the International Space Station. What's your feeling on that one, Paul? Go ahead.
They'll be reboosting it. The Soyuz spacecraft, they use them to reboost it. There's always extra fuel on board them. The automatic transfer vehicles, which is probably three times bigger than the Progress ship, being built by European Space Station every 6 to 8 months, one of those will be going up. That will reboost the space station. The AG-2 being built by Japan, another unmanned craft, will do the same. And then by next year or so, when SpaceX gets their Dragon craft, you know, online, approved by Congress, be doing the same. So many more flights, just unmanned, will be doing that. The space station would be great. You know, I think next month or so they're going to put that unmanned ham satellite, they're going to push that out the back of the space station. Eventually that will be great. I've been following that too. So it doesn't take much. Eventually, I think that'll last about 6 months. Back to you.
And one last question, Paul. The main purpose of the space station is to have sustained microgravity. And that was believed to allow certain alloys and certain medications and whatever to be produced that can't be produced in the real world of gravity. To your knowledge, have you seen articles about what developments have taken place on the International Space Station? I know they've done some very good astronomy work and whatever, but when it comes to materials research and both metallurgical materials as well as pharmaceuticals, have you read anywhere about developments that have occurred so far? Over to you, Paul.
They have dozens and dozens of experiments going on right now, and specifically, you know, the crystals and the different liquids, materials that they're constantly trying to study, and different medicine, things that are over my head, that, you know, because I don't pay that much attention to the science developments that are going on. I know it's going on all the time. It's every lab that's up there, the Kibo lab, this gigantic room by Japan, has science experiments on it. The Columbus module, built by the European Space Station, another gigantic room, dozens of science experiments on that. Discovery, our lab, you know, each one, the Russians, there's all these different science labs up there constantly being used, all kinds of ovens and heating things and cooling things, just goes on and on. Experiments are constantly being brought up and then being brought back to Earth over time, sometimes long periods of time. So specifically, no, I can't really get into that, Dick, outside of the crystals and all of that, but back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you. And now it does make sense. I do remember the AMS, Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, and it's going to be looking for some extremely high power events, which I guarantee Mother Nature is supplying. No matter how strange you think that universe is, it's stranger than you can believe. Okay, this man, Nassim Haramian, an easy name to pronounce, doesn't sound Irish. Anyhow, he has an entirely different way of explaining the weak force, the strong force, and dark matter and dark energy. He believes that we haven't been doing the calculations correctly. He believes the whole darn universe, which has got 10 to the 55 grams of material, I've heard it explained as there's 10 to the 70 particles in the universe, 10 to the 55 grams of total mass. Let me drop. He believes that that is enough mass for the whole observable universe that we see is really one very large black hole. This is philosophy. And he actually does a similar calculation at the molecular level for each individual atom, that he believes that there's a miniature black hole in what you and I call the nucleus, the way the protons are pushed together. And that once you calculate gravity correctly, you don't need the so-called strong force. And he's written a somewhat radical paper on that, and he's supplying a fair amount of mathematics that backs it up. So it could be a rather alternate philosophy, which maybe has some merit. I wonder if that's approximately the way you see it, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, everybody. N2XJN. Well, the Nassim is basing his theory based on Schwarzschild condition. I was looking closely at that condition, and I found that RS, which is the radius of the black hole, equals 2GM, which would be the G for gravitational constant, and M for mass of the black hole. And then all of this is divided by C square, which would be the speed of light. So then, I was thinking, and I came to the conclusion that if we review the model of the Protonderrabase Schwarzschild condition, we find that only very small percentage, that would be 10 to minus of 39 of the percent, of the vacuum fluctuation available within the proton value need to be coherent and converted to the mass energy in order for the proton to meet this condition. So then, this proportion is similar to that between the gravitational and the strong force. As we know, the strong force was invented 100 years ago just for the purpose of, there was need for the strong force to explain, but nobody find out where the strong force comes from. Let me drop. This proportion is similar to that between the gravitation and the strong force, where the gravitation is thought to be, what is it, the 10 of, to minus 40 weaker than the strong force. Then the gravitational attraction between these two contiguous protons can easily accommodate both nucleon and the quark confinement. So, if we take this picture, then we can treat the strong gravity as the strong force. Then we calculate these two contiguous protons, and we rotate them, and get the period of 10 to minus of 23 of S, and the frequency of 10 of to 22nd of the hertz. And this is very much characteristic to the strong force interaction time, and a close approximation to the gamma emission, and that is typically associated with the nuclear decay. So then, include the scaling law, we find that this proton falls near the last square strand line for organized matter. And then, using a typical semi-classical model, we can find that the proton charge orbiting at the proton radius generates a good approximation to the measured anomalies of magnetic movement. And that's the whole philosophy of the theory of Nassim. Do you agree with that statement? And to exchange.
I don't know enough to disagree. I've seen his derivation. I haven't studied it. I don't know enough to disagree. So right now, I don't know. How many other people do you know who have been exposed to this material, and what have they said with that exposure? I'm going to turn it over to you, Wesley, but what does John think of this? Over to you, Wesley.
Well, first, if we take the structure of an atom, then we have electrons, and then we have a nucleus, and then inside that nucleus we have neutron and proton. Now, what Naveen says is, he says that if we look from the perspective of the tetragonal geometry, and I would appreciate if you help me to explain to others what I mean, which you actually saw, then actually we could see everything smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller infinitely. Then we can draw the tetragonal geometry to the smallest and smallest and smallest part, but we could do also in the reverse way. What Naveen claims is that the emptiness that we have in the space, the is extremely dense, and we move inside that density. So would you please just help me with the wording? And to explain.
There are many molecules that, when they're in, or many substances that, when they're in the solid form, they form the equivalent of a crystal lattice. In other words, each individual cell has a particular shape and a certain way that they're bound to the adjacent cells. And a mass center tetrahedron, or a mass center hexahedron, are some of the possible ways that individual molecules could set themselves up. Temperature is the average velocity, or I might say speed, average speed of these molecules, of these atoms and or molecules. And he has gone through a set of mathematics that tries to explain how he didn't need the strong force, he didn't need the weak force, just using gravity. And he's implying that the Higgs particle that the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is looking for, and they believe the Higgs particle is going to explain where gravity is coming from. I think Naveen is implying that they don't need a Higgs particle, that he's got another way of using what he thinks is a more simplified approach to explain the structure. And he, by the way, goes through a beautiful demonstration, let me drop, of how the layout of the mass and spaces between the masses of the universe, the layout and the masses between the masses in a galaxy, a solar system, a cell, and the constituents of a cell, that there's a step and repeat procedure going all the way down. And there's reason to believe that each time we go to a smaller particle, we keep finding that there are smaller particles with the same kind of space between them. And so he has reason to believe that this goes on forever, that there's almost no end to it. That's one of the impressions I've got. Back to you, and I can't explain it all. Back to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Well, I was based on the Glenn's words. He said that we have to deal with the expanding when the energy is absorbed and the electrons are being pushed to the higher orbit. So, the electrons absorb photons when they accelerate and emit photons when they decelerate. And I'm not going to be suggesting the cause of this effect, just nothing in correlation. But that is something that would state about the expansion. Now we know that everything started from the Big Bang and starts to expand. Well, I found a few interesting articles, and I was analyzing them. The conceptual definition of parallel displacement of the vector analog curve in the Riemann space. And I found, so I have made the approach just a little bit slightly different to the Nassim theory, and I found this to be perfectly in line. Now, few interesting factors. Let me jot. Okay. The Christopher Stevens G4ZHT was experimenting with the thermonuclear fusion. At the same time, I found that the conversion of the lead into the gold is in Wikipedia as a factor. That means that atom could create another atom. Now, that's another symptom of ability to expand. And I got a little bit confused in this area, let me drop. Oh, we talk about the transmutation of lead into the gold. Now, in 1939, Lise Meitner was providing this kind of experiment, but the technology was not there. Then the discoveries of 50s helped the industry to generate atom from another atom and rendering to the possible, but not really profitable as of yet, the transmutation leading to the gold. And everything is about nuclear structure and how we perceive or understand that nuclear structure. Now, the birth of the nuclear weapons was actually originating from that same approach. And I would like to hear some comments in this area. I have sent you the number of information about the ham radio operator. Name is Chris, and his generator at his website when he proved that the transmutation took place. Back to you.
Yeah, I think I saw the YouTube video by the ham radio operator who believed he had taken hydrogen and fused it into helium. He had this glass container, or what looked like a glass container, of hydrogen with a set of coils around it. And when he made the hydrogen glow, it had the characteristic yellowish emission. And when the helium glows, it has a bluish emission. And when he ran the machine, he believed he was fusing, doing nuclear fusion of hydrogen into helium. And I'm kind of skeptical about that one, because the sun does do that. But the sun requires millions of atmospheres and tens of millions of degrees Kelvin in order to do that. And I don't think he had anywhere near that condition. Maybe one molecule at a time, you can do it with an extremely powerful particle accelerator. But to really do a whole lot of, I mean, he had what looked like a liter's worth of helium, a hydrogen, and he made it sound like he thought at the end of the process he had a liter's worth of helium. He didn't say liter, but I'm just making a guess as to the size of the container.
I found some information about that when I was looking at his website, and I found that he was using the frequency of 1.81 of megahertz. He was actually looking for the 1,000-watt LC oscillator, and the inductor needs to be at the top, and he was using some low-pressure tubes, hydrogen gas, inside the coil. Now, he has also the website, and the device that he was using is explained over there. The object is to ionize the hydrogen to the to see if the power may be extracted. So, kind of interesting experiment. Of course, we do not know if he achieved anything. And I do agree with you, it's kind of questionable. But at the same time, I have no idea where the strong force is coming from. That's the first question. Let me jump. The second question that I have for you is that when you put the magnet nearby the vicinity of the spark, all of a sudden, the spark is deflected. Now, we know that a photon does not have any mass. Now, another example. The ferrite polarization rotator for the microwave at the frequency from 3.7 to 4.2 gigahertz, let's take this one that was the model FPR1, the ferrite polarization rotator, and now we're dealing with the active microwave. We don't deal with anything that is ionized, and we are able to deflect microwave. So these two questions, I would like to hear the answer for it, if you don't mind. And to exist.
When I exceed 30 kilovolts per centimeter in air, and I draw an arc, a significant amount of current flows through that plasma, through that negative impedance material, and those are real electrons moving in my mind, and the motion of electrons in a magnetic field can easily be deflected, and that's what's going on inside of a traveling wave tube, that's what's going on in the focusing magnets of a particle accelerator. Charged particles that move will, by Faraday's law, Lenz's law, will experience a transverse force in the presence of a magnetic field.
FPR1 does operate to the power of 10 watts. There is no way that the plasma could be constructed, and it takes place as the ferrite polarization technique. Back to you.
Okay, what I was starting to say is that an arc being deflected by a magnet is really the deflection of moving charged particles in that arc.
That's a microwave.
Okay, you said an arc. I'm talking about the deflection of an arc. Now tell me about deflection of microwaves. Where did you see an experiment where microwaves were deflected by a magnetic field?
Well, the microwave application group made a ferrite polarization rotator that operates up to 10 watts of the frequency from 3.7 to 4.2 gigahertz. And the rotation is 120 degrees of minimum. The drive current is 80 milliamp. There is no way that the plasma could be constructed at this power level. But the microwave means photons are being deflected. Am I right or wrong? And to exist.
KC2, QIQ.
In the case of a ferrite circulator, magnetic microwaves are applied to it. The ferrite material has a property called gyrotropy. In the presence of that magnetic field, you have, because of a precession effect going on in the material, in the ferrite material, in the yeek material, it's a yeek-like material, because of the precession takes place, the microwaves that progress in the clockwise manner versus the counterclockwise manner have two different velocities of propagation, and that's how you tune a circulator. A microwave circulator is a three-port device, 120 degrees apart between the terminals, and the gyrotropic effect of that material in the presence of magnetic field allows you to get that selectivity so that the energy you apply, the microwave energy you apply to port one, can comes out of port 2. What you apply to port 2 comes out of port 3. What you apply to port 3 comes out of port 1. In other words, it circulates clockwise, but not counterclockwise. That directivity can easily be 30 dB. Glenn, you want to make a comment on this? Go ahead, K2LIW.
Yeah, bravo, Dick. I just wanted to reinforce what you're saying to Wesley about electromagnetic waves. Magnets, Wesley, their effect on electromagnetic waves